Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller list, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
We don't give people who want to work, we don't allow them to find their dignity. And once you have dignity, you can go out and feel good about yourself.
Brian Mueller has been a war reporter for the Associated Press and the Democratic Republic of Congo, but the war depicted in his new book, The Kings of Big Spring, is more personal, about his family struggle over decades to survive poverty and the wild up-and-down fortunes of the oil industry in windy, sandy, dry West Texas. The Kings of Big Spring is deeply informed by the excellent reporting Mueller is known for, but it's also infused with a knowing, forgiving heart. And Mueller's here this week on his birthday to talk to us about the book. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Clay. Thanks for noticing my birthday. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So you've reported from Africa, as I said, and written books about Africa, but this new book hits much closer to home. What made you want to tell your family story?
The seed of this book started with my growing up, and I tell a story at the end of the book about my dad's friend Grady Cunningham, who was kind of a big swinging oil man in the early 80s. He kind of sucked my family into his orbit. When I was about 7 years old, we moved back to Big Spring for my dad to work with Grady, who had just started an oil company. And, you know, for like 3 years, my family, they kind of, and Grady, like lived like rappers. You know, it was high kind of honky-tonk lifestyle.
West Texas rappers.
and then it just ended as soon as it began. And with us, you know, busted and kind of leaving West Texas for a new beginning in San Antonio. And I'd always wanted to write about that. I thought about writing it as a novel about that experience, about Grady. I'd kind of imagine it like All the King's Men kind of scenario with Grady kind of surrounded by all these people that followed him, these sycophants. And that's what I sold the book on to Colin Dickerman at Flatiron. Mm-hmm. And Colin said, you know, I don't think Grady can really hold a book the whole way. Why don't you go back and try to kind of do some more research? And I was kind of working on something concurrently about my family, and I didn't really realize they could come together. But in 2011, my grandmother died, Opal Mueller, my dad's mother, in Big Spring. And she had been the matriarch of our family for a long time. And she had grown up in the church, Assemblies of God Church, as we all did. And she was a singer, was a beautiful singer, and had been in the choir and sang on the radio. And anyway, we were there at the hospice at the nursing home when she was getting ready to die. And on her deathbed, she kind of looked up and we were all gathered around her. And she asked us to sing the old hymns that we had grown up with and the ones that, you know, had given her so much comfort. So for 2 days we sang with her until she passed. And it was the most profound experience I think I'd ever had. And I wanted at that moment to kind of get to the root of that feeling, because there was something moving in the room. It was called the Holy Ghost or something, but it was there. And it kind of led me on this path. And then I realized at that moment that I could do these, I could kind of converge these two stories. And so with that, I went back into my family's history and just followed the rabbit hole down. And I had some incredible bits of luck along the way that kind of connected, bridge the past that I probably wouldn't have been able to, otherwise. So,
yeah. And so how have you been able to reconcile the sort of, conservative faith that you grew up in with your political ideals? I mean, has that been difficult? I mean, clearly that religion still retains a hold for you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even more so now. I think one lesson I learned from this book is that, I'm exactly like my father. I'm a seeker.
Should we start playing Neil Young?
Yeah. I'm a seeker, and I think it also is my age. You know, I'm turned 43 today. I have three little kids, and you know, kids start asking questions, and so you know, as I was writing this, I kind of began probably my own faith journey, not anything like my father or anything like my aunts and uncles in the Pentecostal church where I grew up, charismatic Pentecostal. Because I think everybody has a kind of come to their own understanding of God or what they think God is. And it's just through this book, I'm trying to like kind of build the capacity for the mystery in my mind, you know, mm-hmm. and try to figure it out. And I've been doing that. My family is very conservative. Yeah. It's tough these days. Because none of us really see eye to eye on many things. Ugh. I've been very adamant about keeping dialogue open with my family. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really like a lot of people who just won't go to Christmas or,
right.
you know, I'm very close to my family, my Republican family. And so, yeah, I think, but, you know, their faith was very informative to me. And I understand it. And I understand why they came into the Assemblies of God Church, why they were holy rollers during that period. And I understand why my father lost faith and mm-hmm. came back to it. I mean, it was one of the most kind of revelatory experiences of my life, you know,
yeah.
to see it and kind of try to forge my own path based on that.
Yeah. So you mentioned when you were younger that your family had to move from Big Spring because after all the like boom times, there was some serious bust times. So that must have been, you know, really jarring for you. But that's actually a dynamic that your family has experienced for a number of generations, right? Partially because your family was working the land and living off the land, and the land in West Texas is famously
cursed.
Inhospitable. Talk a little bit about, you know, repeating that dynamic and researching your family and figuring out what your family had gone through years and years before.
Yeah. You know, these were great discoveries. And, so yeah, we had to move after the bust in early 1983, we had to move to San Antonio. My dad had to take another job and kind of started from scratch again. And, but yeah, going back and doing the research, I realized that that's been our story since day one, since we came in from Georgia in the 1890s. And we were working people, you know, mm-hmm. we were hillbillies from the East who showed up in these boom towns, and we kind of hitched our wagons on the booms and the busts, and there'll never be a boom without a bust. And so we ride them up and we ride them down. And, you know, if you farm cotton or drill for oil, you're gonna go broke. And it's still that way today. And, I think moving to San Antonio, my dad kind of got out, he kind of escaped that cycle a little bit, but it's still happening with my family. One of the great things about, being a reporter and a researcher is that, I got to kind of put these tragedies of our family, you know, these moments when we went broke and had to move or, and I think those carried a little bit of shame for my family a little bit, you know, that we couldn't provide all the time for our families or our kids, and that times were hard. And, but what was great about it was that I got to go in as a historian and as a journalist and put those in context of history. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were just an ordinary kind of working class family. I don't think anything about us was that significant, but when history, you put them in context, it tells of history, you kind of can tell an extraordinary story. And for my family, it really put their kind of their suffering in context, and they go, Oh, that's why we had to move.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, in a strange way, history can kind of make one family's pain less painful in a way.
Yeah.
And context is a valuable thing.
Right? You realize that you're just riding this huge wave, you know, yeah. that you're on this wave. And now it's funny because, you know, my family didn't know their history. Like a lot of families, I think, in this country, we didn't know where we were from. And you got to know where you're from to understand where you're at.
And who you are.
And who you are.
Yeah.
And so now it's funny because every time we go to any kind of family reunion or whatever, people come up to me and ask me questions about our family. And I've become sort of the de facto historian, but
yeah.
it's a role that I'm glad to have because, I've interviewed everybody. I've done all,
right.
I've done all the work. I've overturned all the stones. And so
there's this, moment in the book. It's very brief. But there was a rumor that your grandfather murdered someone when he was a young man. What were you able to find out about that allegation and whether it's true?
You know, these stories are all over my family. That was kind of one of the seeds for me because when I first, the story you're talking about was my granddad and his father, my great-grandfather during the Depression, having no work in West Texas because the oil field had all laid down, all the rigs had laid down. They bummed trains to California, to the Golden Valleys of California to pick fruit and cotton, and like a lot of people did, and along with all the Okies and whatnot. But my grandfather had a notorious temper,
mm.
and you know his mother had died at a young age, and he was ornery, he was mean, kind of mean as a young kid, and. At this time that they were bumming on the trains, he was a teenager. And there had been a rumor that one of the railroad bulls had turned up murdered.
Didn't tell people what a bull, what that's sort of an archaic term nowadays.
Right? Yeah, railroad bull is the railroad police that they monitor and police the train yards and the trains. And during that time, there were some notorious railroad bulls, especially in Texas, Texas Slim, you know, guys like that. These kind of notorious, almost like gangster figures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they had had run-ins with bulls several times on the trains that my family told me about. One of them got my granddad. They caught him on the train, and once the train started moving, he waited for the train to gather speed and tossed him out of the open door, and he, you know, nearly killed him. And so I imagine he was pretty pissed off when he encountered some other bulls. So I don't know if that story is true or not, but my granddad had a pretty good temper. There's another rumor that kind of started me out. You know, they said my aunts and uncles, and they said, well, you know why we came to Texas is because your great-grandfather killed a man. And I said, well, that's dramatic. In Georgia, he killed a man and he was fleeing from the law. And I never could figure out. I never could find that. I mean, I scoured newspapers. I scoured it. Never could figure that out.
Yeah.
And then there was another rumor. You know why we came to America from Ireland? Because we killed a man. We killed a priest.
Your
we killed
family.
Not just a man, but we killed a priest. And I said, Christ on a cross, we killed a priest? And I went and actually dug up that rumor. And it turned out not to be a rumor, but the twist was we didn't kill the priest. We were the priest.
Oh.
And so
you were killed.
I have a martyred ancestor in Ireland that was killed by Cromwell's forces. Anyway, but they almost had it right. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is why we came.
A little bit more sexy to say that your family has a murderer instead of being murdered.
Right.
So with a family history like that, I mean, were there family members who were reluctant to talk to you?
No, not one. It was... my family are storytellers. They're very proud people. And you know, I think it was, I came at a time when some of us were dying off, you know, when the older ones of our family were dying off, and especially my grandmother. And when she died, it really hit us all hard. I had interviewed her, actually, my grandmother, several times, when I would come to Big Spring or when I would see her at family events, but I never had done any extensive interviews with her. But I found those notes as I was writing, and so my family were really happy to talk because they like to learn about themselves, and they like to learn, as I mentioned, they like to learn how we fit in history, and especially my cousin Homer. I mean, he likes to tell stories and he likes to talk. So I had some very, I was very lucky that I had these storytellers that could just, I ask a couple questions and they'll just talk, you know.
So what about these dark moments? I mean, murder, alcoholism, poverty, mm-hmm. certainly violence. Did you ever have to sort of hesitate to tell the entire story?
No. I approached this as a journalist, you mm-hmm. know, and I was very removed from it, you know. Yeah. It wasn't until like I started writing about my parents toward the end of the book that it became even remotely personal for me, mm-hmm. you know. I treated my family as any subject I write about. And I just try to profile them and try to, I don't know, make their story come across as interesting. And you know, my family's funny because they said, you know, if it gets kind of boring sometimes, just make something up, you know? and so I did not do. But it turned out to be a lot more dramatic and a lot more interesting than I ever would have imagined, because of the people I found, like my cousin Francis, and who was, I mean, that was a journalist just dream gift, you know, to find her, you know.
She had a really rough upbringing. Mm-hmm. So going to sort of more, you know, contemporary times, I mean, you've got a lot of great details in this book, but one of them is that on the day that your parents brought you home from the hospital, your mother leaned over your crib and apologized. What was she apologizing for, and how did you get that detail from her?
She was apologizing for the bad parenting that she assumed that she would be responsible for, because she was 20 years old. My dad was 19 when they got pregnant with me, and I remember myself at that age, I don't know anything, man. Mm-hmm. You know, much less how to raise a child. That's been a story that I've heard since I was a kid. You know, my mom tells that story to people all the time. So, it wasn't hard. I think I just asked her about that story, because her burning the, her dropping the flaming skillet and burning the whole linoleum and all, and throwing away the cloth diapers, you know.
Yeah.
In the dumpster, you know.
One of the sort of, I guess, themes running through this book is poverty and how to escape it. And it seems to me like there are more books about wealthy people than about poor people for, you know, an obvious reason. That's that poor people don't really have as much access to documenting their stories or having their stories told by other people. And added to that is that life in the oil fields, certainly during the Great Depression, which you spend time writing about in this book, was chaotic. Mm. So how did you, are there histories of life in the oil fields? I mean, how did you, you have great details from that moment in history. How did you find those moments?
One way was that I found just through family, you know, who remember these things and handed down stories from my great grandparents or grandparents. But there weren't many of those stories. You're right. I mean, for the first like 50 years from the 1890s until the, no, not 50. So 1890s to the 30s, I was all relying on documents, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until I found my cousin Francis, who was born in 1925, that the 30s kind of came alive a little bit in color. Yeah, accounts of the oil fields in West Texas. Wink, Diana Davids Hinton, who is a researcher and a historian at UT Permian Basin. She and her former husband wrote a lot of great books about the Texas oil fields. And I interviewed her and relied on some of her books. And there's a lot of book research that went into those early chapters, just to get the details, because I knew that we lived in Wink in 1935, and so I found a book about Wink in 1935. You know, of course, my family's not in that because we were just roughnecks, but that detail was relevant, you know, and so I was able to kind of just fuse all that together. You know, I wrote this, like, my guide, I had these, like, these pillars of truth, you know, and these were, you know, what I knew my family had done and significant periods of history, and I laid them all out like studs on a house, you know. And then I used this book stuff and book research to kind of like fill in the walls and everything of the structure. And, yeah. and so I had these moments, these kind of touchstones that I could jump from. So there was a lot of good book research.
Yeah. You know, you're not, a policy wonk. You're a writer, obviously. But one of the sort of ideas that keeps running through this book is that there is a cycle to poverty, and that it can be a difficult thing to escape. Have you thought about, contemporary, current policies that would help people escape poverty?
Healthcare. Mm-hmm. I know from my own family, healthcare. Back in the 30s, there was no safety. There was before the New Deal, there was nothing, and which I'll get to in a bit. But the church was the safety net.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the main reasons I think we came into the church, because it provided the safety net where there was none. The church was there for you when you were sick. They were there for you when your kids died of some infection that we could probably cure now. They were there when you needed some food, and they were there for you. And then the New Deal came along, and the New Deal helped my family out a great deal. My granddad and my uncles were New Deal Democrats up until the 80s, mm-hmm. because of Roosevelt. And even if you remember back then, there was still a lot of pushback from conservatives about the New Deal. They hated it, this kind of handout stuff, but, it saved a lot of us, and saved our town and saved, your cattle starts, they're sick and dying and.
Yeah, because there's this great moment in the book where your family was, I forget how many cattle they were trying to sell, but they were thin and maybe mm-hmm. even diseased. And so they didn't get the full, mm-hmm. Amount that the government, that the New Deal government was able to pay.
Yeah.
But it still helped your family, right?
Absolutely. Otherwise, what are you going to do with them? They're just going to die. And, the government came and I think gave them like $9 a cow or something. And, mm-hmm. Other family members got jobs, building parks and building the roads. And, there's nothing back then. There was just nothing. And I think, that applies today, it's all about, you got to give a man some dignity. You got to give people some dignity. And I don't think we do that anymore. We don't give people who want to work. We don't allow them to find their dignity. And once you have dignity, you can go out and feel good about yourself. And if you know that you're going to provide for your kids, you know that they're going to have a doctor when they get sick. And we're just not seeing that anymore, really.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to end it on a negative note, but the book does have a lot of hope in it. It's a great read. It's The Kings of Big Spring. And congrats.
Thank you, Clay.
Wow, Clay, a working class hero is something to be.
I know. Well, especially that his family has survived through the West Texas landscape and all the ups and downs of the oil industry all these years. It's pretty amazing.
Of course, my ears pricked up when he mentioned that his family came to this country because they killed a man, but not really. It turns out they didn't. But my family did.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, really. My ancestors are straight up from Corleone, Sicily, a little town outside of Palermo. Perhaps you've heard of it.
Yeah.
And my great, great uncle killed the murderer of his best friend's murderer.
Wow. Gosh.
He killed the murderer of his best friend. Yes.
Well, I think you too have a memoir in your family memoir in your future.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at PodcastOne.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
I'm not good at research, Clay. That's my problem. But the author I'm interviewing today is, and I'm so excited to speak with her.
She is very good at research. Tell us more about her.
Boasting a sinfully delicious blend of fiction and fact, The Mitford Murders by Jessica Fellows is set at the turn of the 1920s. In London and Oxfordshire and in between, it centers on a real-life unsolved murder as investigated by characters including one of the real-life daughters of the famous, fractious, and fabulous Mitford family. And more on them in just a minute. The Mitford Murders is the first in a series of mystery novels planned to focus on each Mitford sister in turn. There are six of them. They're already slated to become a TV series from the creators of The Crown and The Replacement. Fellows is a journalist, author, and public speaker best known for the New York Times bestseller The World of Downton Abbey. She joins us today from her publisher's offices in New York City. Welcome, Jessica, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Congratulations on your debut novel, The Mitford Murders.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's still very thrilling to hear that each time, actually, to have finally done it. It's my 10th book, but my first novel. So it feels very different to everything that's gone before.
Well, it's interesting because one of the many pleasures of this book for me is the pleasure of the procedural in the way it so wonderfully unfolds, you know, to give us this full, immersive, golden age English crime fiction experience. So, therefore, I thought we could, you know, adhere a bit to the procedure here and establish at the outset that you are the author of the New York Times bestselling companion books of the Downton Abbey TV series.
Yes. Yes, I did 5 books for the TV series in the end. And I mean, apart from one of them, which was a collection of my favorite quotes from the show, the books were really what was exciting for me and what was interesting for me about writing them was that although they do talk about the making of the show and the costumes and the interviews with the actors and so on, what was really great was being able to delve into that era. So it was about exploring the real life inspirations behind the show. So whether those were historical events or whether it was just general social history or whether it was anecdotes from my family at the period, because the show was written and created by my Uncle Julian. So a lot of those stories I had spent many hours discussing with him when I was growing up as a child, and it had sent me off into that era anyway. Was it, you know, it's a period that I've always been fascinated by, and all of my favorite authors are from that time, the Between the Wars era. So it was a natural fit for me to go there for my debut novel. But also, I really enjoy it. I'm as fascinated by it as I ever was.
It strikes me as your fellow journalist, as The Mitford Murder strikes me as kind of a delicious blend of fact and fiction. I'd wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your journalistic roots.
Yeah, well, I began as a journalist. I started working for the Mail on Sunday, you know, in the usual time-honored way as a sort of tea maker and photocopier. back in the day when we still used photocopies, many hours spent doing that. And then I kind of worked my way up slowly through the magazine, and I, you know, ended up doing a lot of celebrity interviews and a bit of a Gossip Girl column and lifestyle features and so on. And then I left there and I went on to be deputy editor of Country Life magazine, which you're more Anglophile listeners will know. And that really kind of gave me 5 years in a very iconic magazine. And I mean, I just learned so much. There were no celebrities really involved. It's all about these unbelievable experts and people who knew a lot about English way of life, the big country houses, the gardens, the kind of antiques, the slightly more eclectic, eccentric elements of English life, rather fashioned and gentle. It was a very nice place to be. And then I freelanced for a few years. So I had a lot of respect for people who respect history, and I learned a lot from them. And although history had really been, you know, had been one of my major subjects at school, it had always been taught in a slightly dry way, I would say. And I began to learn that it was, you know, it's not about a rundown of dates. In fact, what I found really interesting, really exciting about history, what I still really love about it now, is that it isn't an absolute subject. You know, you've got so many different people with their different views and different takes on how it really worked. And we know that because, you know, if you ask your family exactly what happened on Christmas Day in 1986, you're going to get 14 different versions if there were 14 different people there that day, you know, and, mm-hmm. and history is no different. And so it's just, you know, so there's so many different things that you can look at and explore. And then I think, you know, but then I think also we have a lot to learn from it, you know, in terms of giving us a little guidance, a little experience, you know, in living our lives today. Sorry, I probably went a rather long-winded way around that question, but
I am greedy for information as a journalist. So please, as long as you'd like to speak, have at it.
Thank you.
I find at least two equally important strands plucked from history and elaborated for the cause. We have the Mitford sisters here, and we also have the murder of Florence Nightingale Shore. Would you please introduce those two to our listeners?
So, okay, well, first of all, the Mitford sisters. These were six sisters who became notorious, really, in that period between the two wars. They kind of came of age at different stages, you know, because they were obviously born, you know, quite some way apart. And they all came from a fairly sort of unremarkable upper-class family in England, but they all grew up to be rather remarkable women in their different ways. And what was interesting for me to use them as a hook for a series is that I can kind of hang my hat on them, if you like, as each one is a shortcut to explaining or illustrating something about that period, whether it's the politics or the glamour or the satire or the country life or the aristocracy or whatever. So each novel of the series will focus on one sister at a time more than the others, and we'll go through it kind of chronologically. So this first book, The Mitford Murders, begins with the elder sister, who's Nancy Mitford, who many people will know as a brilliant novelist. And she wrote in a very funny, very observant, very sharp way about her class and about her family. So she's in this book as a young girl. We meet her about sort of, you know, sort of 17 years old. And so she's on the cusp of leaving childhood behind and going to become an adult, which she finds very exciting. And accompanying her in this fictional journey is a nursery maid who I invented to go and work with her, Louisa Cannon. Because what I'm sort of interested in, if you like, is, you know, one has the facts of history, and the Mitford sisters have had a lot written about them, and they wrote a lot of letters to each other, and there's been a lot of, you know, there's been lots of biographies about them, and lots of speculation about their lives and who these different women were and what they grew up to be. There's, one grew up to be a communist, another a fascist, another a lover of Hitler, another a duchess, you know. I mean, it was all quite, they're all quite extraordinary stories. What I'm interested in is what kind of got them to those places, you know. So what happened in those gaps in between? And so we put them into fictional situation, and I'd sort of see how they behave, if you like, you know, in there. So I've, separate to that, but concurrent, when researching this novel, came across the real-life murder of a nurse called Florence Nightingale Shaw. And she was the goddaughter of the famous Florence Nightingale. And she was an extremely accomplished wartime nurse. And she was in the Boer War. She was in the First World War. And then just 2 months after she was finally decommissioned, she took a train journey down to the coast. And she was brutally attacked and left for dead. And then, this is in January 1920. And the murderer was never found. And I discovered the possible connection geographically between Florence Nightingale Shaw and the Mitford sisters. And once I had done that, I was like, this is just, you know, it's too good not to put together. So in the novel, you know, we have Louisa Cannon, who's our nursery maid, you know, she gets kind of caught up in the murder and the solving of the murder. And with that, you know, she had Nancy with her, who's this ace sort of storyteller and enthusiastic sleuth as well. And so we're together with the help of their friend Guy Sullivan, who's a policeman, we solve the murder, I think. But I mean, you know, it's a sort of, in some ways, it's a sort of a naughty thing to do. And it's a kind of quite delicious thing to do. But also, I really want people to engage with the past, not just as a place of stories and fantasy, but as something that is very real, because it was real. And I think it's important that we don't patronize the people of history. And there's a tendency to do that sometimes, where people say, well, you know, because people sort of were born then into that era, they thought like this, you know, they did things like this. And they didn't, you know, they were us in different clothes. They were just as complicated and emotional and messy and confused and trying their best and all the rest of it. You know, there were maybe slightly different context and maybe slightly different expectations of life and so on. But they were real people. So I think, you know, all we're doing is taking some real people and just imagining how they might behave in a certain situation.
I thought it was an especial celebration of Florence Nightingale Shore, a person from history of whom I had never heard before, and I'm glad to know her. Mm. She was presented, she's the first character presented in the novel, but she doesn't stay alive for quite so long. But we come to know her through the investigation of Nancy and Louisa, and we come to know her through her own letters and through interviews with people who had come in and out of her life. And she sounded, by all accounts, like a tremendous stoic, but still progressive, caring nurse on the front lines. So
yeah, she was a heroine. And you know, I mean, the thing is that what was interesting was, you know, what I did have to hand. So the letters are fictional; I wrote those. But the court kind of interviews and things, I took those from the newspaper reports at the time, and. So, you know, there was enough detail, you know, to piece together a picture of her. And it was quite a significant crime at the time. I mean, people did find it shocking. You know, she had been this nurse. She was in her 50s. She'd lived a long life. She survived so much, you know, and then she doesn't survive a perfectly innocent train journey in the south coast of England. You know, so people did find that, you know, pretty awful. But I have a line in the novel at one point where somebody says, you know, you don't see the nurses on the parade, do you? And I really felt quite strongly about that. I went to do some research at the Imperial War Museum in London, which is, you know, which is a very brilliant museum about all of the wars, but got a particularly good section on the First World War. And I tried to find out about the nurses, and there was just one tiny little table, you know, with a little bit of information. And those women were just so extraordinary. You know, they were so brave. They were a mile from the front line sometimes in flimsy tents. And Florence Nightingale Shaw was written about afterwards as somebody who refused to leave her patients even when the bombs were going off. You know, so she risked her life daily as much as those soldiers in the trenches did. And yet they don't really get the war medals. You know, they don't get the recognition. Their names are forgotten. And so I was really pleased to think that a side effect of this book would be to bring her and the likes of her to people's attention. So I'm really pleased to hear you say that. Thank you.
Of course. Our reviewer seemed very pleased with the book. And at one point in our Kirkus review, I don't know if you've had a chance to read it.
I'm not sure if I've seen it yet. No, sorry.
That's okay. Don't read the reviews. No, you know, no need. But in our case, it is quite laudatory. And the reviewer... you know, calls out and says that it's quite an enjoyable, plucky protagonist or heroine in this book. And then I realized to myself, I'm not sure that I know which character I'd choose as the protagonist or heroine between Nancy, Louisa, and even in abstention, Florence. What do you think?
I mean, for me, in lots of ways, it is Louisa, just because I suppose because I invented her, you know, she's particularly close to me, and because I know I'm going to be with her throughout several books, so I did want to, you know, I did want to create somebody that I could spend that amount of time with. And there is a particular type of woman from that era that I'm very interested in, which is Louisa, which is these are the women who were brought up before the First World War. They were brought up with the expectation that they would lead the same lives that their mothers and their grandmothers and their great-grandmothers had. they would, you know, and it was, this was the same across all classes, actually. But what was particularly interesting in the working class scenario was that the mindset changed completely. So after the First World War, not only did the women, many women, understand they were not going to live the same life because there simply weren't enough men around, you know. You know, it was a very high probability that they were not going to get married and have children. And so they would have to go out to work and support themselves. But for the working class, there was also a different mindset change in that they started to allow themselves to believe that they didn't have to live the life that had been handed to them. There were other work opportunities. Just, you know, there would, it became easier to travel. And so it became easier to kind of go and work somewhere else. You know, you didn't have to stay in your village. You didn't have to work on your father's farm. You could get educated. There was sort of a breakdown of the belief that, you know, the upper classes were natural rulers. You know, so they could be stood up to, they could be questioned. And so that's who Louisa is, you know. And I think what I really like about her is that she is determined to escape her mother's life. But she goes towards the Mitfords, and is that really a, like, that's a bit of a stretch too far, you know? So kind of where is she going to find her place? And she is bright and she is brave. But at the same time, you know, she's got an awful lot of sort of heavy expectations on her. You know, we all know what influence is. A chance remark made to us as a child, you know, it can still be affecting our decision-making process 30, 40 years later. And so if you've been constantly told, you know, that you are somebody who's going to live the life of a drudge, you know, and to allow yourself to shake that off and think differently takes a great act of will. And that's Louisa. That's why I'm really interested in her. But I agree. I, you know, there's lots of kind of powerful women in this book. you know, you can take your pick. You can take your pick. But I hope that, you know, I'd really like that if everybody felt they had, you know, different readers may feel they have different people that they identify with or relate to or dislike or, you know, but react to in some way. And if I managed to do that, that's just would be amazing.
I think you've managed. And I thank you for spending your time with us today. The novel is The Mitford Murders by Jessica Fellows. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I loved what she was saying about that sort of line between fact and fiction when you're, you know, writing historical fiction that has real life characters.
Yeah, me too. And really in reading this, you know, classic English murder mystery, I really was drawn toward the idea that a novelist of this ilk is in a way a detective.
Yeah, and that, and also what she was saying about making the past real, you know, sort of moving beyond nostalgia. That's so crucial for somebody who's writing historical fiction. I also have to say I loved it when she said it was a naughty thing to do, because when British people say that, it's sort of cute. Because you don't really feel like it's was maybe all that naughty, you know?
Well, you know, by our standards, surely not.
That's right. All right. Should we ask the editors which bestsellers are really worth our time this week?
I'm dying to know.
Okay. So we've got our nonfiction editor, Eric Liebetrau, our children's editor, Vicky Smith, and our fiction editor, Laurie Muchnick, on the line. They are going to tell us about the hot books out this week that they think you ought to be reading. So Eric, in nonfiction, what are we lacking there?
So this week, a new book on the list. It's called The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Tragedy in Vietnam by Max Boot, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a expert on kind of counterinsurgency and how we've fought these kinds of wars in the past. And anyone who read Neil Sheehan's classic book, A Bright Shining Lie from the late 80s, will enjoy this one as well. It's a long, long book, over 700 pages, but it's a really insightful, probing study of kind of a lot of the things that went wrong in the Vietnam War. And I think it has a lot of lessons that can be applied today, certainly for Afghanistan. Boot is very good on looking at the importance of nation building, how that, you know, The other thing is that it's often that if there's an insurgency, if it has popular support, it's also extremely difficult to bring down. So a lot of the stuff that happened in the Vietnam War, we're seeing happening in the Afghanistan War as well. And so I think this is it's a timely book. I mean, it's a book about Vietnam, but it's also something, it's a little similar to a book I mentioned a couple months ago, the Mark Bowden book, UA 1968. I think if you like that book and you have an interest in Vietnam, this is kind of a natural next step. So yeah.
Yeah, this book is also arriving at a great time because we're, you know, the Ken Burns documentary, I mean, we're still as a nation, you know, reckoning with Vietnam. And maybe more interestingly, I mean, writers are still finding, you know, really interesting new angles to write about that war. So
yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that they'll continue to do. And especially as we seem to be making the same mistakes over and over. I think, you know, reexamining what happened in the past and not the distant past, I think is something extremely worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right.
Turning now to children's literature, I think Vicki has a little bit more of an uplifting suggestion for us. Vicki?
Yeah, it sure is uplifting. I am thrilled to see how much love is being given to Love by Matt De La Pena and illustrated by Lauren Long. And before you roll your eyes and think, how can we possibly have yet another picture book about how awesome love is? Just banish all of the cliches that are floating through your head. It's not about bunnies. It's not about these sort of idealized farm settings. It's not about happy people in the suburbs. It's about how fundamental love is to sort of human existence. And it conveys this by showing how love can get children and families through hard times instead of these sort of idyllic, blissful times when it's sort of easy. So it has these sort of, it's a very impressionistic take. You see different families in different situations. Most of them are poor. Many of them are people of color, but all of them are really ennobled by Lauren Long's illustrations. He's got this very muralistic style that sort of takes you back to the WPA murals of the 1930s. So it's got this very sort of American folkloric feel to them. And so when you have this style that is accompanying words that remind children that love is there, even if your parent has to leave so early in the morning that they don't see you and your older sibling is giving you burnt toast for breakfast, that is love. And it's that kind of love that they will be giving you to take on into your life. So it goes so far beyond the usual every child should be loved and love is wonderful book that I think that everybody should be buying it and giving it even more love.
I wish I had interviewed the author, because there's a really good interview with him by Kelly McEvers over at NPR on All Things Considered that I would recommend that listeners follow up with if they're interested in learning more.
Or just go and check it out or buy it, by golly.
Yeah.
So that's a ringing endorsement. Go out and buy it. Laurie, what do you think people should be buying in fiction this week?
Well, I have something that kind of fits in with both of the previous books that were just mentioned. It's Kristen Hannah's The Great Alone. She's the author of The Nightingale, which was a huge bestseller a number of years ago. For years, I think it was on the bestseller list, which it was about some sisters in the French Resistance during World War II. This book moves forward in history to 1974, and it's about a troubled Vietnam veteran who was a POW and came back, you know, unable to sort of settle down, having kind of all kinds of anxiety disorders. And his wife and his daughter, they move around. You know, the girl is 13 and she's gone to 5 schools in the last few years. And then he inherits a piece of land unexpectedly in Alaska from one of his friends and comrades in Vietnam who died. So they just kind of on the spur of the moment, totally unprepared for what their life is going to be like, move up to Alaska, where they find a community who will help them. It's got a kind of Little House on the Prairie vibe as they learn how to, you know, stock up with food for the winter and get ready for what's coming. And of course, it also has connection to Vicki's book, just about how love keeps this family together through some very, very hard times.
Nice. Yeah, it's a different, certainly a different setting and sort of landscape than The Nightingale. So it'll give her fans, of which there are many, something totally new to experience. Well, thank you to you all. And Laurie just mentioned Krista Hanna. She is going to be on next week's episode. So we hope you join us then. Now you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Podcast One has new shows on our new app. Check out all the cool features to help you explore our exciting new programming, like America's Lakers podcast with Jay Moore, So Random with Corinne Olympios, Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast, Not Just Sports with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen, and Sessions with Randy Jackson, as well as your old favorites like The Lady Gang, Steve Austin, Shaquille O'Neal, and Adam Carolla. Get the new Podcast One app in the App Store, Google Play, or podcastone.com.